It is Saturday, December 30th, 2006, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, we're doing some predictions for 2007, and of course, geek news and your calls with questions and comments of technology.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Geek Speak is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics. Offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services, Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Socal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Today on Geek Speak, we're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. That's during the second half. The first half brings you some geek news and a little bit of predictions of technology to come in 2007, help define 2007. Of course, you're welcome to join our conversation in the second half of the show. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or contact us right now. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Listen to the unique voices of our community on First Person Singular, bringing your local artists and poets, novelists, students and teachers, community activists and retirees with their stories and anecdotes on a wide range of topics. That's First Person Singular every Monday, Wednesday and Friday at 7:30 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. on Sunday afternoon at 4:58 p.m. just before weekend, all things considered, only on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP. Geek Speak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam. He's the technical trainer at Surf Control. Sean Cleveland, the technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. And Alex Slias via phone from Orange County, application security analyst for Fidelity National Financial. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Wow, maybe I should turn all your microphones on. Of course, Alex was on, but hi, guys.
Good morning.
Hey, there we are.
And Alex, you're with us?
Yep, I am.
You're soft-spoken, but there. Nonetheless. Well, I will start news with Sean, I believe.
All right. Now I can hear myself.
Yeah, the mic's up now, sir, but then.
So.
Don't you love listening to your own voice? Oh, is that just me? Okay, so go on.
You love listening to my voice? Wow.
You are in a mood this morning, aren't you?
I am. So, according to dailytech.com, kind of an interesting place for news. Actually, it's interesting because they post their comments. You know, people could post comments on every news item on the same page. So you read through the news, and then you read all of, like, hundreds of comments from people. And it can be kind of interesting.
This is News Tech?
It's dailytech.com. So they have a story. Toshiba has announced their second-gen HD DVD player. It was supposed to come out in December, but it won't be out until January 3rd. It is the HD-XA2. This player... It's kind of interesting because it supports 1080p, and which is, you know, nothing's being broadcast to 1080p, but if you download a lot of online video is available now in 1080p. So if you have a media center player, you can actually play 1080p content, and that's progressive. So 1080 lines of resolution.
Someone's doing progressive DVD. HD at home. You're doing that now?
Through my media center, I can play 1080p.
So you're always using Windows Media Player to actually play, and are you using Media Edition of Windows?
And then there are up-conversion DVD players that convert from 480 to 1080p.
Do you have one of those?
Yeah.
And do you notice it?
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Hmm.
But when you play native 1080p content, it's just incredible. It's stunning. But to do that takes a lot of processing power. So it's very difficult to do. You need a really high-end media center. This Toshiba second gen HD DVD player probably has a decent processor or a DSP chip that does the same thing. It'll have to go DSP if they want to bring the price down. But what's interesting is the price. It's a grand.
Is that cheap for them?
Well, it's new technology. They charging this amount of money because they know they can get people to pay it. A lot of early adopters don't care what the price is.
Sure, sure.
And, you know, it's a way for them to make a lot of their margins up front. So when they finally bring the cost down, you know, they've paid for a lot of the initial technologies and investments. So probably won't expect to see players in the price ranges of $500 or even $300 for another 12 months. But I kind of like the specs on this unit. I'm glad they're going for the high end right away. So when they come out with, you know, a version that has been price reduced,
then you'll grab one of those.
Yeah.
All right, Sean, thanks for keeping us abreast on the HD technology. I'm going to learn all about it tomorrow when I experience your television firsthand. Is that Sunday? That's Sunday, I guess. No, tomorrow, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, it's...
Do you want to give out your address to the Central Coast of California by chance? No.
Not
so much. Public. All right. Hi, Miles.
Speaking of high-definition players, the digital rights management technology built into HD DVD and Blu-ray... also known as AACS, has been cracked.
Yeah, I saw that. The source code for the crack was posted. I guess the guy who did it is promising to post the rest of it this next week.
Yeah, so it's going up on the net. It's over. People can rip their Blu-ray discs and grab the content.
What technology? Is it Blu-ray specific or is it just HD?
Blu-ray and HD DVD are both using the AACS DRM.
Has that been verified? I know I've seen rumors about it, but not much in verification.
Hi, Alex. Good to hear you.
You know what? I'm not sure.
People are worried. I bet at this point, if it wasn't, we would have heard the news that it was actually a hoax or something.
So AACS system was developed by Walt Disney, Intel, Microsoft, Toshiba, and Sony.
Wait, by Walt Disney?
Yeah, Walt Disney played a part in that, too.
Mr. Walt?
Well,
or the company? The company is actually called Walt Disney. It's not just Disney Corporation. I think it's called Walt Disney Corporation.
So, Disney,
but I could be wrong.
So it's Toshiba's HD DVD technology, Sony's Blu-ray. They both use AACS.
AACS. Does anyone know what that stands for?
Nope.
Advanced Access Content System.
All right.
Advanced Access Content System.
This is the technology
that prevents high-definition discs from being illegally copied. And all this was supposed to be done on hardware. So you needed to play any of these technologies back. You had to have HDMI connection, and then the hardware codec had to be built into whatever device was decrypting it. It was all supposed to be done in hardware, and then transmitting over this digital signal was supposed to prevent any way to get access to that signal.
Right.
A lot of people are upset by that because they bought in. To high definition sets that did not have HDMI because HDMI connection is fairly new, so that you're using component connections and you can't
get the quality.
You can't hook up an HD DVD or Blu-ray player through component. What'll happen? You can, but you can't get the HD signal. It'll downgrade the signal.
I was doing some research on what some predictions of technology for 2007 are going to be, and somebody, Ross Mayfield's blog, he mentions one of them is going to be digital rights management is going to hit the mainstream. And we've been talking about digital rights management, you know, for quite a while, since the Millennium Copyright Act, really, when we started getting kind of concerned. As a mainstream issue, it hasn't been there. And I think it's true that it makes a lot of sense that this year, as more people are actually, you know, buying HDVD players because they're getting lower than $1,000, for example, we're going to start seeing a lot of complaints about, you know, well, I have all this hardware that's really expensive and it's a real pain to do this.
Yeah.
And it's about the ease of use that I think is going to really get people hooked on getting rid of the DRM rules. So
DRM's
since
become,
this is cracked.
That's going to be a mainstream problem this next year.
Yeah,
digital rights management. It's going to be
talk a
mainstream. Stream problem this next year.
So let me ask you about the digital rights management of this crack. Is this equivalent to the crack that happened a long time ago, the DVD players?
Yes.
Okay.
But let's really talk about this, okay? What does this mean exactly? So somebody has found a way to take a Blu-ray or HD DVD movie and rip it to your hard drive.
Okay, so now I can go to Blockbuster and I can take this Blu-ray, rent a Blu-ray disc, take it home, and make a copy of it.
On the contrary, that's not all that it's about.
It is also about
playing it on other operating systems like Linux or using players that are not sanctioned by the MPAA.
Okay, so that's one of the arguments for doing this. I mean, first off,
it takes $1,000 player.
Yes.
You know, first you have to have a player to read the disc.
But aren't the computer Blu-rays cheaper than that?
No. Well, okay, so you can buy the Xbox HD DVD external USB player.
For?
That's $200.
Okay, $200.
And you can hook that up to your computer and you can rip HD DVD movies.
If you have
the software. There is not a Blu-ray equivalent. There is, but it's $1,000.
Okay, but if you have this hack.
If you buy this Xbox HD DVD drive, you can then rent HD/DVD movies and rip the movies to your hard drive.
If you're using software that has this crack built into it.
Because you got to understand, he's just got the source code, the blueprints for cracking it. Somebody actually has to take that and build it into software that makes it easy for you to rip the movie.
Does anyone know who this is, Miles?
He goes by Muselix64 handle.
But let me finish. Yeah, go on.
So once you rip it to your hard drive, it's going to take, I don't know, probably 10 to 15 gigs of space, right?
Right.
Huge amount of space. Well, it depends.
It depends on if you're downsampling or not. But in the original,
well, why would you downsample? I mean, you might as well just buy the DVD then. The whole beauty of this is you've got, you know, pure 1080 content, high definition content. It'd be dumb if you downsampled it. So you could downsample it, but then you might as well just watch the DVD. The whole idea here is to take it then to your media center and then play it on your big screen in a native HD, you know, resolution.
Well, but Miles is saying you could of course compress it, so you could reduce some of the 15 gigabytes that can actually fit on the tape on the
but
disc.
The whole idea is to
watch the whole thing.
People do it with DVDs though. They DVDs are a certain resolution and they downsample it so it doesn't take as much space on their hard drive.
And you know what, most people don't see the difference because they're watching it on a television set, but if you're watching it on an HD set, you can see the difference.
I personally don't own an HD set.
We're talking about why would you do this?
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Well,
what it would take to do this.
Yeah, with the current prices, yes. But as I said before, like with DVDs, it is impossible to watch a DVD without technically breaking the law on Linux.
Right. Okay. So Miles just wants to bring up the idea of why this is a kind of a responsible thing to some degree, because the companies actually are holding on to, though you purchased this piece of this disc, you can't actually play it and you can't do anything you want with it. So it's that whole rule set about restricted ownership.
Yeah.
So you don't actually
own
it.
The fact that it's been cracked is a huge deal.
It's equivalent to getting a book.
But I just want to understand what people can use this technology for right now, and it's just
right. I get
the
that.
Barriers to entry.
So one
even
of, so one of
to,
things you're
play with this is
one of the things you're concerned about is that you'd have to buy a $1,000 piece of hardware to actually play one of these discs, or you could buy a cheaper disc.
It's a $200 piece of hardware.
But that's you'd have to use the
only for HD DVD, not for Blu-ray.
For Blu-ray you'd need $1,000.
Yeah.
What you'd ideally want to do is then take that video on your hard drive and then re-record it back into a high definition format onto a disc, but unencrypted.
Right.
So you could play it on anything. And there's no way to do that yet. You can't even buy media.
Okay. So what Miles, your point though is that if you're using an operating system like a Linux operating system, which is not sanctioned or something by this company, why aren't there tools for playing this stuff on Linux? Why is this so difficult?
A lot of the tools that are on Linux are open source, which means that the decryption key would have to be open source as well. And that is the case in a lot of ways. For example, with DVDs, there's a library called DCSS, that CSS being the name of the encryption algorithm used for DVDs. And like I said, if you want to get it to work, a lot of times on Linux you have enthusiasts who are just writing the code to get it so that it works on their system. They're scratching their own itch, as it were. And even though you may have purchased a DVD, which I've purchased many, I wouldn't be able to play it on my player, not because of any intrinsic deficiency of my computer, but simply because the player wasn't sanctioned.
Okay, let me ask this. Sean, you're talking about the cheaper HD, not the Blu-ray, but the HD USB drive that's a DVD, HD DVD player.
And the Xbox.
You could plug that into a Windows Media Center, and without buying or not using illegal software, if you will, or the software that's been cracked, could you play HD content from that disc?
Yeah.
And you could put it out to your television?
Yeah.
Okay. So... So
a lot of people are doing it.
Yeah.
They're selling these things hand over fist, and they're not being hooked up to Xbox 360s.
But you can't without this crack copy that disc and make a copy into your
correct.
Home media center or play it on different source or anything like that.
Correct.
All right. Thank you. I think that's great to get kind of abreast of what's going on with that. It's really interesting that it was cracked again. I find it fascinating that DCSS, the DVD one was cracked quickly. I would think that they would have improved it completely. So fundamentally that it wouldn't have been cracked. So how could it have been cracked?
Any puzzle devised by a human mind can be, can be disassembled by another human mind.
But you and I can have a conversation through our chatting software, and we can use encryption. And Sean, no matter what he does, can't really get to it unless he has a massive amount of computer power. So why is that a secure connection? But
you
doing this DVD. What's that?
There's a secret in that. And I mean, you're exchanging a secret key as opposed to just based on an algorithm.
So is that the deal, is that the DVD stuff, because there's so many players out there, it has to be an algorithm that you share?
Exactly.
It can't be a secret.
If you have a secret, that's just going to be found because it has to be shared to each of the players.
I see. So really, it's a difficult dilemma.
Well, for them it is.
I'll go with an agree, yeah. All right, so Alex, would you like to handle the next story, sir?
Sure, actually. I came across an article on Security Focus where bot infected PCs are getting a refresh. It seems on Christmas Day, a lot of the organizations that track the threats on the internet have noticed a significant drop. Some are stating 20%, and others are stating 10%. But still, there's a significant drop in the number of bot infected PCs that have been detected out on the internet. Consequently, I'm guessing that we've probably seen a slight decrease in spam, although I guess in the recent increase we may not have noticed it. And it's largely, I believe, they're thinking it's due to people buying new computers and opening them up and replacing the old computers, and those old computers that were infected are no longer running on the internet. So it's kind of interesting.
Windows 95 and Windows 98 machines, you mean?
They may even be infected XP machines, but, you know, hopefully we're getting rid of those 98 and 95 machines especially.
The idea being that as people buy new machines, the old machines go offline.
Exactly.
Yeah, makes sense.
So we've kind of seen a decrease in the infected machines, which hopefully means a decrease in the strength of these botnets that are producing spam or other malicious activities.
I like that. No, don't you think that a lot of people that buy a new computer take that same old computer and have two machines running and get a little hub at their house?
No.
It depends if they're a geek or not. I mean, you got to think, a lot of people just don't want to deal with trying to hook up two computers on a network and get them to talk. And
there has to be a massive amount of work. I mean, if you got an old 95 machine, you're not a geek, you buy a new computer for the new year and you want to get your data transferred over. I mean, how do people do that aren't like us that can do what we do? How do you do that?
A lot of people don't collect data. They don't back up their email. They read it and they delete it. They don't have bookmarks. They just
photos?
Go to a few sites.
They may have files, though. A lot of people have files.
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to be a lot of files.
I helped a family recently with the same kind of problem, and they were even running XP, and I gave them new hardware and helped them out.
And it was just
a mess of transferring data. It was a real pain. It took a whole night. And that was me doing it.
You just stumbled on the answer to your question there, Lyle. Mm. They go find a family member who knows how to do it for them.
They go find a geek sucker.
And we all know exactly what that's about.
Yeah. And to all the family members that I have out there, I know nothing about computers. And
I mentioned a while ago, I got in a car accident, and I'm buying a new car, and I hate buying cars. I hate it so much. So I'm like dealing with all these issues and stuff, and my aunt goes, well, call your sister. She knows all about that because that's what she does for a living. I'm like, wow, I can call a family member and get advice. So I called my sister Adria yesterday, and she returned my call, and it was just a plethora of information. She was so useful and said so much. I was so thankful. I'm like, thank you. I was like slobbering on the phone. Thank you so much. You're great. And I realized, oh, that's why people are always thanking me, because it really is helpful when you don't know the answer and you call a sibling and get the answer. Do you, either of you, call your sisters for help for anything?
So your sister became tech support.
Yeah, she became tech support for cars. But
for cars.
Sean, do you ever call your sister about Blockbuster? No?
No.
No.
I only call my sister because I care about my sister.
I wish my family members called me because they cared about me. No, it's always about the computer or their phone and the resolution.
Yeah, I can call. Yeah. I'm texting a lot of people.
next news story, Sean.
Oh.
Did I surprise you? That's my goal.
I'm ready to talk about you know,
more tech
predictions and wishes and things. But, you know, I think Alex has a bunch of stories, and I like to hear some of his stuff.
All right, Alex.
Great. All right. I guess there was a report that Gmail has actually lost some email for people. In fact, it lost all the email for a number of people.
Whoa.
The true scope of this, I don't know how large it is. They're stating, or at least in a message they sent to TechCrunch.com, they actually stated that it's around 60 users were affected. But I don't know. It seems like it might be a little bit larger than that if people are commonly finding, you know, posting about this in the same place. But I don't know. Have any of you guys lost your Gmail lately?
No, I saw that news story and my Gmail's fine.
Yeah, I checked mine.
It's kind of interesting. You can check your email and actually you could try to delete all your Gmail and you wouldn't be able to. But some people got their email deleted. How does a company that has, like, how could Google lose the data? It must be temporary loss. They must have a backup of it, right?
You would hope. They said they're working with individuals to get their email restored. You know, they do want to save face on that. But there's also, I mean, they say that they've been working to identify and fix the problem, and you know, it's really uncertain. Is it their problem, or is it some vulnerability that was out there and the browsers were hit with a cross-site scripting attack that told Google Gmail, delete all my email?
The thing is you can't delete your email from
Google. Also bear in mind that Google is not like a standard company where you just get some backup media or backup tape and go. I mean, Google is so massive. The amount of data on Gmail is so massive, you're not talking about your typical backup routines anymore.
Yeah.
You're talking about very likely.
But they design an infrastructure that clearly has a redundancy. They have to.
Oh, sure.
There's no way they could run the system.
Sure, it has some redundancy, but who knows? Maybe it's a localized redundancy and that failed for
or non-localized and just that the failure propagated somehow. We had that event happen at work, UCSC work. We had a situation where there was a machine that was authenticating users and there was a script in the mail. If the user had been deleted from the system, the primary system, delete their email because, of course, they didn't exist anymore as a user. And the connection between those two machines failed, and so the mail subroutine just deleted the accounts. And the same type of thing where you have a system in place for deleting the account, and that system targets it. And if it's effective, it's very effective. I think it's kind of interesting. None of us were affected. I haven't checked my Gmail. Sean, you affected yours? Checked yours?
I have not checked.
Okay. Next news story. I'd like to. Yeah, Miles.
Robotic deers. Robotic deer, I should say. It's the plural. Has been set up to capture or to catch illegal poachers. Up in the northern areas, especially around Wisconsin. What you have is a robotic deer that...
Are you making this up?
No, I'm not.
Is this April 1st?
No, a deer hanging by the side of the road, you know, and as a car goes by remotely, the deer will be made to turn its head to look over at the truck. And, you know, the truck stops, goes over, someone goes like, oh, hey, deer, you know, takes out their gun, takes a shot at it, and then... cop car comes out from behind a bush and goes like, hey, you're doing illegal poaching, and hauls him in and finds him.
That's insane.
Yeah, so it costs about $2,000 for a robo deer. You put it in the side of the
road.
How
many shots can it take before it dies?
And they've officers have reported collecting well over $30,000 in fines with a single robot.
Is that one person? I mean, how many the fines? Okay.
No, that's just... It's hard not to laugh at that. I'm just imagining this little robot deer sitting around, turning its head around, looking around.
Full of holes. Does a police officer have like a patch kit and go over and go to the holes?
Well, presumably the deer has a bit more robustness than a real deer in terms of being, say, bulletproof or bullet resistant.
I love the ingenuity of it. It's perfect. It's simple. I'm sure if you could get very complicated by having like cameras in the eyes or whatever shoots at it, there's a photo of it, and they have to track the person down. But I like that it's just kind of sitting there, and there's a cop across the street waiting until someone stops and shoots.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to be
deer,
a lot
elk,
more robots.
Moose, and bears. They have all these robotic decoys out there.
Pretty soon you're driving along in like a Disney theme park. Look at all the animals, Mommy! There's actually no more black bears in the United States. But look, Mommy! That's a robot. No!
And somebody writes a virus so they attack people.
That's how the doom will come.
It's coming right at us.
All right. This This is Geek Speak. You're listening to Geek Speak. Let me see what I'm supposed to be doing here. Geek Speak is supported by Henry Jerry Meres, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. I'm lost all over the place here, guys. KOSP co-sponsors First Night Monterey 2007, Rhythm and Hues. Don't miss the New Year's Eve community celebration for all ages. The streets of historic downtown Monterey are transformed into a festive setting featuring music, food, singing, and dancing. The first act starts at 3 p.m. with Twilight Parade at 5:30 p.m. Button passes are on sale at all Monterey County Longs, Rite Aid, and Safeway stores. For more information, First Night Monterey's New Year's Eve celebration, please call 373-4778. Or go online to, you guessed it, firstnightmonterey.org. Cool event in Monterey. Do you want to drive down there? Or I guess we're going to be doing stuff at your place, huh, Sean?
You know,
I love First
Nights. There's no more First Night in Santa Cruz, is there?
You know, it started and it was going down and it was up and there was financial problems. But, you know, Monterey is a... I love Monterey. I'm not going
downtown. Downtown's kind of interesting. I haven't been there in a long time.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. All right, GeekSpeak is supported by CruiseIO, providing local internet services, including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about CruiseIO membership is available online at CruiseIO.com or by calling 459-6301. Fun fact, the people that actually own and operate CruiseIO started GeekSpeak before they passed it off to us years ago. So it's one of the reasons why they...
And it's all downhill from there.
It was.
what happened, you know?
I don't know.
What were they thinking?
It was a change from Monday night to Friday morning that nailed us. And, you know, we got loopy, and we just never stopped being loopy.
I blame you, Lyle.
I think it's mostly me. It's like I like hearing the sound of my own voice. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. The geeks in the air with me are Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. And we have Alex Leas down in Orange County calling in with a bit of a cold. But, Alex, you're sounding good to me.
I'm hanging in there.
We're going to start taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'm going to do those again nice and slow. 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Of course, you can send us email anytime. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. And we use a web form because we like to reduce the amount of spam that comes to us. So we won't put you on a list or anything unless you ask. And then we have to put you on someone else's list because we don't have any lists. And anyway, call us, email us, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-KUSP. And email us, geekspeak.org. I think we've got calls coming in. Let's confirm that. I don't sound as smooth as I do. Normally I'm like trying to pretend that I don't have a computer in front of me and that I'm getting communicated with three different angles. But today I'm just feeling sloppy.
I don't think he had enough coffee this morning.
That's what it was. It was also withdrawing a bunch of money from the bank for a car.
Wait. Alex just said an instant message. I love my robot. He's got an iRobot Roomba.
Oh, you do?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those things are they're pretty neat. I got one for Christmas, and it keeps my floors pretty clean.
Are you going to mod it?
I, you know, I've been reading up on those sites. I'm so tempted to do that.
Are you going to make it look like a deer?
No.
Put antlers on it. So, yeah, used to go under furniture.
Yeah, the Roomba could be...
Maybe I'll get it like a little costume and put reindeer costume on it.
The Roomba could be an armadillo, no problem. It's about that.
So how can you mod it? What mod is most interesting to you?
I've only just like started touching on those sites. I'm not sure exactly what I can do to it, but
so you can do a whole bunch of stuff. You can put, I saw one kit. Man, I should find that URL.
So
somebody put a webcam on it and a wireless attachment, right? And didn't remote control it, but just had a video feed. So they had a webcam that was their Roomba. So if you watch their webcam, every once in a while, it would move around the room. And
so for people who don't know what a Roomba is, it is
it's a small robot vacuum cleaner. It costs under $1,000, and it's plug it into, you have a base station in the corner. Alex, does it work in your room?
What was that?
Describe it a little bit for us.
Well, it's basically a little round kind of disc about 3 inches, 4 inches thick, and it turns itself on when I have it scheduled, and it goes around the house because it kind of uses different patterns of movement to, I guess, ultimately ends up covering your room. So it kind of does different patterns of bumping against the wall and kind of following the wall or doing a little spiral in the middle of the room or, you know, traveling across the rooms. It's got, like, these different patterns and eventually covers your entire room.
And it mapped your room first, right?
You know, I'm still trying to figure that out. I don't think it actually keeps a mental image. I think it does it through algorithm of movement. I'm still trying to, like, confirm that or not, but based
on
what
I'm... That's a cool Christmas gift.
It is. It's pretty cool. My mom got me.
Your mom.
Yeah, my mom. Yeah, she got me this great little robot.
See, my mom's an artist, so I don't get anything. I get paintings, actually. Okay, let's go ahead and take some calls, because that's one of the reasons why we're here, right? The last show of 2006. We're going to go ahead and go to Watsonville. Judith, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, thank you. I'm calling. I've been having a problems with syncing my .Mac mail with my address book with the one on the desktop, and it's a problem getting really connected up to the server.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've been trying to troubleshoot this, it was suggested that I go to this page and check about my DNS server.
Okay.
And one of the things it said on the page was that if my browser takes me to the apple.com site, when I enter the IP address for that, mm-hmm. there's a problem. And it did that. It took me to the full page. And one of the things they were suggesting is being sure that my DNS servers and my network preferences were there accurately.
Wait a second. Why would that be doing that?
Were you able to pull up the page when you were you typing in the name, like, you know, apple.com or...
Well, no, they gave me some numbers like 17 dot, I forget exactly the numbers were,
sure.
But it was, I guess it's what's called the IP address as opposed to the domain name. Is that?
Okay, let's ask you this. If you, can you search the web no problem? I mean, can you use the web no problem?
Mostly.
Okay, well, if you type in Yahoo, or if you type in geekspeak.org, for example, you'd go to our website?
Yeah.
Okay, so your DNS
occasionally
is...
Occasionally, I can't go to a page, but I think that's because they're old or dead or
sure.
something.
Sure. From a perspective of DNS, it looks like your DNS is working. Like, that's all you have to do to know if DNS is working. Now, it's possible that there's some advanced DNS features for the .Mac account stuff that they're using that not all DNS servers provide, like equivalent to an MX record. Alex, do you think that Apple's doing anything weird like that? Why would they do that?
I don't think there's anything weird about how that works.
They're just using web dev, right?
Well, especially for iSync. I mean, it's just connects up and synchronizes the data.
I don't think that's the error. I don't think that's the reason you're having problems with iSync. Also, the IP address they gave you, was that specifically about the .Mac accounts?
There's the IP address is just for apple.com,
uh-huh.
but the page they gave me was on the Apple support site that was, and I'm having email correspondence with the .Mac support people. But this is just one of the things that
Wait a second, you're getting professional help from Apple, and you can't get it fixed, and you're calling us? I'm flattered.
Well, it's just one part of it. They gave me something to troubleshoot, and I couldn't get this address. And
I'm pretty sure.
I'm
pretty sure that's a dead end. So what's going on with websites? Okay, a domain name, a DNS stands for domain name server.
Yes.
And so when you say I want, when you put in your browser and you type http://geekspeak.org, what you're doing is you're saying, hey, domain name server, which is probably by your ISP. What's your ISP?
It's AOL,
okay.
And they have, I guess, automatic discovery.
Yes, you're starting to know so much about DNS that you don't need to know. Like, this stuff should all be transparent to you. And I think that Apple's leading you on the wrong path in this regard. So basically what's happening is AOL, your service provider, has some servers set up. And when you ask for geekspeak.org, they look into what's called Alex or Miles, what's the central repository of domain names? Like, where... Registry.
Well, are you talking about the root servers?
Yeah, the root servers. There's a
Where are they physically?
How many are there? There's thousands of them, right?
There are 13 data centers, at least there were like years ago, but that's not necessarily individual computers.
So there's a whole bunch of places that have these large collections of who owns what domains and what IP and what server to ask. So this is all about domain name server.
The root servers are not the same as the .com servers.
I know.
So
basically there's... What happens is your domain, the geekspeak.org or AOL.com, is checked against a big repository that looks for the .org or .com. And then there's a list of servers that say, okay, geekspeak.org is actually registered to Lyle Troxell, and the server that's supposed to respond to that request is hosted this IP address. And so it gets translated to IP address. And then from there, an actual IP address of our server is responded to you. So in the background, the machines are all talking with IP addresses, but humans interact with domain names. And the translations of those is the domain name servers. So if you can use your browser with just using domain names, then that's all working for you.
But should you not be able to use your browser putting in IP addresses?
No, that's totally fine. In fact, you can always use your IP addresses on a browser. There's some situations that would actually fail.
If the server is set up to only allow domain names,
yeah,
or allow the host header, actually.
For example, I'll use the GeekSpeak website, for example. GeekSpeak website server hosts geekspeak.org and hosts troxel.com and some other sites of ours. And if you visited it just with the IP address, you'd only get the GeekSpeak website. You wouldn't be able to get the other websites.
The GeekSpeak one? No, the CorkDog one, I thought.
I think GeekSpeak's the default. Anyway.
You'd end up with only one site.
The web servers are kind of expecting those domain names to exist. So you want to use domain names, not just IP addresses. But there's no problem using an IP address. That's not the problem you have. Apple's leading you astray. And I think we've covered that.
Okay, well, thank you very
Certainly.
Much.
Certainly. So much thank you for that call.
Okay.
It's funny, when people call in about stuff I actually know about, I start rambling on. And
well, let me make one note there, Lyle, for the caller. You know, hopefully she's still listening. But
I wouldn't
double check. I'm assuming that Apple has already walked her through this, but just go to your system preferences and check for the .Mac settings. Make sure that your account info is set up correctly there, and make sure that in the sync tab that it actually has checkmarked your contacts and the other things you want to synchronize to your .Mac account.
Yeah.
It's possible it could just be a simple configuration setup, and maybe they didn't walk her through it thinking it was a bigger problem.
The other thing I'm curious about is the .Mac stuff just using port 80 with WebDev, or is it using a special port?
I'm not even sure about that.
See, the thing is, if she's got AOL as the ISP, I can't imagine that AOL would be blocking because there's so many users in AOL. Anyway, food for thought. I hope she
figures
it out.
We have a ton of calls.
All right, let's
keep
going.
We haven't even talked about predictions.
I know.
Such as, will GeekSpeak get Apple on the show in 2007?
We've tried so many times.
I don't know. Yeah.
From Santa Cruz, Ed, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello?
Hello, Ed. You're on.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sorry. I got a question about, I guess it's proprietary software. I had a gateway a couple of years ago, and with that gateway computer came an edition of Office 2003. And I moved on from the gateway, and I'm trying to install the Office 2003 in another machine I put together. And I keep getting this pop-up that says, this is not a gateway machine.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, is there a workaround for that?
You could get an upgrade to Office and use that.
I don't know. That disk probably is keyed to gateway system. So
that's horrible, but he owns
that
software.
So these OEMs, they get software from Microsoft, and it's licensed specifically for their machines. And what they do then is go in and change the software so it only works on their systems. It's like taking an OEM version of Windows XP and trying to install it on another machine. A lot of times it won't work because, you know, that company stripped out all of the drivers and all of the support for everything else. So they've made a version that only supports their hardware.
With Office, though, I'm
wondering what they could do. They must have done something to the software.
To check, yeah.
I'd be curious. Particular device is sitting on a
You could try this. I mean, this is just a simple hack that I would try right away. When the disk inserts, it's going to auto run something, and it's going to be a gateway branded thing, and then it's going to give you this error. On that same CD, there actually might be an install package of Microsoft Suite in a subfolder. So browse the CD and see if there's some other place to launch it. That app might not actually be restricted. So it might, like a top-level restriction, which would be simple for them to do, or a modification of Microsoft's. But they're so huge that they might have just made the real modification. The next thing to do would be a legal course. It would be kind of is that old gateway still running, or is it retired?
It's retired.
Okay, so what I would do, it's very possible you could send a letter to Gateway and say, I bought this computer from you. With that, you gave me a license of this office. My computer has since crashed, or whatever, but you're not letting me use that Office suite, which I paid for.
Uh-huh.
So you can try to get them to give you a full copy of 2003. And that might work. You know, enough people might have gone through all the hoops and hoodles, and someone might have sued and all that. I just said hoodles. that might work for you.
Okay, well,
you could do some Google searches.
Yeah.
Google search, okay.
See if some people have run into this issue. Unfortunately, I don't have experience with this.
No, me neither.
Okay, well, thank you for your your couple of suggestions there.
Certainly. We got them coming out of our ears. Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
We're going to go right to, well, we can stay in, let's see, where are we? Ah, Big Sur. Okay, Jim, welcome to Geek Speak.
Yes, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I have a guy building a website for me to sell my photography on, and he said, okay, go to your site, look at the first draft of logo set up. And I said, hey, it's the strip running across the top doesn't go all the way. He says, what's your resolution settings? I said, well, I got it pumped all the way up to, I don't know, what is it, 12? It's
1280.
1280. And he says, well, I'm building this for your, for the mid-range, like, what, 10.7, 10,000?
1020.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
1024 by
720. Because that's where most of the people have their machine set.
Yep.
That's what they can handle. And so I dropped down to that, and I remembered then that I had set my machine farther up. Because, I mean, I'm a graphic artist, you know.
Right,
I can't
sure.
take that crap. The way that looks when it's down low, that mm-hmm. low resolution. So here's my question, guys. How do we build a site
that works for everybody?
That works for everybody. Is there some kind of auto switch that we can build into the site that reads the machine setting of the person chiming in or gives them a code?
You can definitely
not reliably,
but you can definitely design websites that will work, that will scale to the full size of the browser.
Yes. But that's a whole other issue.
Well,
what you're talking about is, like, you're used to print publishing, for example, where you make a poster and it looks exactly right. You make a magazine, like, front and it would look right. And the web is not that. The
right.
web is a completely different medium. So,
but even if you sent out PDFs, which is a digital version of a still thing, and you send it to a computer that was running at 1024 and yours was running at a larger, if you open those up and you show them at 100%, you would see more space around it than the other person because your monitor shows more width. So you're always going to have that. You've set a different setting than somebody else. And if Miles looks at this website on his phone, it's really not going to work because his phone has a browser, but it's only 2 inches wide.
Yeah, but phones are horrible for looking at the web.
So. I'm not saying they're not, but I'm just saying that people have different views, and it's one of those acceptance things. Now, you can design for it in a more effective way that looks good on all browsers, you know, different sizes. And the issue with that would be like a header image. What you want to do instead is design the image so that there's image on the left and there's image on the right and there's some expansive area in the middle that kind of allows it to grow without it being an image.
Because text can be resized. Yeah. It'll just flow wider.
So there's
on a wider
it's
browser.
It's all about design stuff, and
really,
it's hard.
Yeah, but you're really targeting, instead of, say, print media like 300 dpi, 600 dpi with screens, you're going what, 92 dpi, 96 dpi.
Yeah. Oh, I see, because of the yeah.
So that's going to be your target, really.
Okay.
So it's both things. The designer can do things a little differently to be more fluid, and you can accept that the web is not like print and accept that fluidity is okay, that it's going to look different on different browsers.
Well, basically what I'm doing now is I'm having him design it for that 1200.
Yeah.
If
he designs the 1200 and someone has only 1024, they're going to go to your site and they're going to have a serious problem because now things are going to be scrolling off the right-hand side.
Right.
Yeah, I would recommend going with it.
See everything on the edges.
What's that?
They would have to scroll to see
That's
everything
right.
on the edges, right?
And Alex, what's your recommendation?
I was going to say, I'd recommend not going over 1024 if you're going to design for a size, because most people don't go above. I mean, I've watched my own websites, and the stats 25%
of people with machines are set on 12.
Sure.
But obviously the bulk are below that.
That's right. So the question is, do you want to make 25% of the populace happy that visit your website and have everybody else kind of frustrated and not want to be at your website?
You know what? Something else to consider, too. People with very large screens usually don't maximize a browser window
That's right.
to the entire screen. I keep mine windowed.
Yeah, I keep mine windowed about 1024.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and look on the bright side. You have 1024 by 768 to work with. Back in the day, we had 640 by 480 or 800 by 600. So things are getting better.
All right. It's just
frustrating.
Well, you know, the idea of tuning into my website and having it look all fuzzy and crummy to me just drives me nuts. But okay, so what you're saying is essentially...
What's your website?
It's luminouslands.com. It's a photography website.
Is it live now, the new version?
No, not the latest. Mm-hmm. Just an earlier trial, a look of the first page, just the logo in the top.
Maybe you should have smaller pictures that you click on to make larger ones.
Well, I'm going to have a medium size one photo and then thumbnails.
Well,
so
the recommendation I think we have is design for 1024. If you want to ask your web developer to make sure that the page expands to full width, you can. It's a little more difficult. If that web developer is having trouble with it, there's definitely books to do this kind of thing, and there's great websites for it.
Okay. Let me ask you one more quick question. My hosting, I guess my ISP, is GoDaddy.
Uh-huh.
They want to charge me... for every single image that I put up there, just like I was selling refrigerators or cars, you know.
Oh, because you're using some kind of service of theirs for photo sites?
Yeah, if I'm using their store service.
Yeah.
They want to charge me for every single image. Well, for a photographer, that's crazy. What is there a site? Is there a hosting service I can go to that doesn't operate that way?
I'm sure there is. The thing with GoDaddy is they have really great rates for the base services, and then all their add-on packages they make a lot of money on. I use GoDaddy a lot for different websites and stuff because their base rate's really cheap. But I don't buy those extra features. And you can definitely find wonderful websites for photo management and photo selling. Since you're in Big Sur, I wouldn't mind recommending Bay Photo. It's a local company. They do a lot of print work, and they actually do have services for professional photographers where you can buy stuff through them and even print stuff. Bay Photo. Do you know Bay Photo?
I use them to process my stuff.
But talk to Bay Photo about website hosting and what
they
do.
They do that too?
They do some of that for event work. You know, if you're a wedding photographer, you can do all your photographs through them, then put up all your photographs online, then you give an account to the couple that got married, and then they can go up and pick photos and print them and have other people go in. So it's kind of like a print ordering system. I'm assuming that they also have some website hosting stuff.
Alex, do you have a recommendation?
Good luck with that.
What was that?
Do you have a recommendation?
There's another one that's actually pretty popular. I'm assuming they have more expanded services for a small fee. But photobucket.com is really popular hosting your pictures.
Good.
All right, so let's do another prediction. Sean, you got one?
Yeah, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize in the world of hardware, there are a lot of new fabs coming online. And these are places that actually produce chips. Samsung has one that they announced. It's a 40-nanometer NAND fab plant, and that's NAND memory is used in flash drives. And cameras, it's memory that can be written to, and when the data is turned off, it holds on to the memory. Well, they're talking about building 64 gigabyte memory cards. I guess in total,
wait, how big?
64 gigabyte cards. But there are a ton of other fabs from companies like STMicroelectronics, Infineon, Intel, AMD. 17 new fabs are coming online for 2007. So my prediction is we're going to see memory a lot more devices coming out in 2007.
So what do you mean more devices?
Cars, cell phones will have much larger memories. They're really small.
You'll see laptops without hard drives.
I mean, memory is going to become huge.
Static memory, flash memory.
Yes,
or
flash
non-solid state. Solid state memory. I like that idea. I think that's good. Thank you for that prediction.
And the prices are probably going to come down dramatically because so many people are coming into the market.
What's the max size on some of these cards? Like these cameras and stuff we have with SD and all these memory sticks, and we also have Flash 2 cards. What's the max size the actual device can handle? Anyone know? If you get these large things.
It depends upon the device. Different devices have different requirements.
Depends on the size of the card. Like a compact flash card for cameras, I think you can get a 32 gig now. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I haven't done any pricing or research.
I'm wondering if the camera can handle it, but yeah.
Well, Secure Digital comes in many different sizes, but for example, my old Zoris, you know, will take a 1 gig chip just fine, but not a 2 gig.
So
even though they're available in like 4 and 8 gigs.
Sure, sure. All right. Any more predictions from you geeks?
God, there.
Because I got another call we can take.
Let's take a call. Take a call.
Let's see what we got. All right, let's go ahead and take. Man, we're full on phones. We'll go ahead and take Cynthia in Santa Cruz. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello. Oh, yeah, you actually got to me. Sorry. I'm surprised.
Surprising.
I was. Let me turn my speakerphone off. I don't know how to do a lot of things. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. I was looking into going on a high speed. What is it, a DSL line, I guess, through AT&T, and I discovered that I absolutely now have to change operating systems because my OS won't support the technology. So I have to go from Windows 98 to either XP or Windows 2000. Mm-hmm. And my question is there a way to download that from the internet, or do I have to actually go out and buy a physical CD?
You want to buy a physical CD.
Yeah, okay. And do you have any recommendations as to which one of those systems would be?
Get Windows XP, not Windows 2000. But I don't know. Are you a pretty geeky person?
No, not at all.
Okay, then you might need help with this.
Okay.
This is for AT&T DSL?
Yeah.
You shouldn't have to upgrade. Don't get me wrong. I would love if you upgraded off of Windows 98. But you shouldn't have to, technically.
Yeah, they say you need to, but you don't really. You'll probably be okay. Well, I mean, they
probably won't support you.
They probably won't support you very well.
But
then again, your computer might not support Windows XP. Your computer might not run Windows XP very effectively. So what I would do is get a new computer.
AT&T usually gives the... I just went through this with my father.
It's just all website stuff, right?
Yeah, you'll get like a router that's a firewall.
Yeah.
And it's got what's called PPPT.
PPPoE.
PPPoE, yes.
Yeah.
And what that does is it automatically connects to, AT&T, whoever your hosting facility is. It dials and keeps the line open for you.
It does everything for you.
So all you need is a computer with a network connection, like an Ethernet.
Does your computer have an Ethernet connector?
Does it have any what?
Does it have a network connector?
If you look on the back of it, does it have like something that looks like a phone plug, but it's actually
wider?
Oh, wider
than a phone plug. I don't know.
If it doesn't...
Okay, take a look, because...
If it doesn't, you'd need to go to the store, buy a $15 card, plug it in, install the drivers, and then hook up your router.
But then you're going to have to...
That's the worst it's going to get.
...card that supports 98, too.
I think that's true. I think I'm going to hire the now high school... senior who designed my web page.
Oh, wait a minute.
Perfect.
Hire the high school sophomore.
Yes, do that. Hire the high school senior.
My internet site.
Oh, wait a minute. The routers come with... I think these routers come with USB connections. Check if it comes with a USB connection, you just plug it in.
And hire the geek. Hire the student. Yeah. And yeah, definitely.
You might need some help.
Yeah, definitely do that.
Yeah.
But it's definitely doable.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And or pay the $300 for a computer.
Yeah. Cynthia, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you for taking my call. Bye-bye.
But we're back to that story where I don't think we talked about it on air, but all these Windows 98 people, they're the ones who are causing the spam.
That's true. GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com, which, by the way, they'll help you out with the computer as well. The geeks this morning were Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, and from Orange County, we had Alex Lias. Thank you, geeks, for being with me. Rick Philman answered the phones. Thank you so much for being there. And thank you for listening to GeekSpeak. And for those that called in, thank you for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out. And who wants to listen to that? GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and used by permission. This is Central Coast Public Radio KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, or on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.